who became blind, and on another group who have lost the use of their limbs, paraplegics who had been in accidents. And the investigation was focused on finding out whether some of these people, despite these horrible tragedies that happened to them, were able to find a way of living a life that was more or less tolerable. And what he found, to his great surprise, is that many of these people not only found ways to live a tolerable life, but they actually found that their life after the accident, after the tragedy, was in many ways more focused, more purposeful, more meaningful than it had been before. It's as if the tragedy made it clear to them what they had to do in order to live a life that was harmonious, that was autotelic, that is self-rewarding. For instance, one of the subjects that were studied was a young man of 30 years old who had lost his sight when he was 24 years old, and here is how he described what happened to him.
First, although I recognize and accept my limitations, I'm going to keep attempting to overcome them. Second, I have decided to always try changing the situations that I don't like. Third, I'm very careful not to repeat any of the mistakes that I make. And finally, I try to be tolerant with myself so I can be tolerant with others.
Now, this young man who is now 30 taught himself to play chess, and he is going to all kinds of international tournaments. He just had come back from Spain where he played in a championship. He also swims competitively, and he had been to a swim meet in Sweden where he competed against other people who had some handicaps. Now, this kind of a focus and consciously living life was something that he lacked before the accident. He just went along doing things that were mildly interesting, mildly enjoyable. But now that he knows that he has to either sink or swim, figuratively speaking, he either lets this horrible event, the loss of sight, either he lets that destroy his life, or he has to learn to be in control of his situation. And fortunately, he chose the second course. He chose to make the best of the situation in which he was before, and now he is doing things that he never thought he would be doing. Another respondent that was studied was a woman who became blind at age 12, and now she's 33. And she also enjoys her work. She's a switchboard operator, and she thinks of it as being an orchestra conductor as she's switching the calls back and forth. And she says, "When I'm working, I feel like I'm God or something. It's very fulfilling." She feels that she has become more mature as a result of having to take control of her life. Problems no longer bother her like they do her friends who are still sighted. The point is that before she became blind at age 12, she felt that she was at the mercy of a family that was really not very loving, not very caring, and she felt that she would never amount to anything. But then, as a result of the accident, she realized again that it was up to her, that nobody was going to help her. And if she let go at that point, she would be completely helpless, whereas if she learned to help herself, she would be able to pull through. Another example was a young man who lost the use of his limbs in a motorcycle accident. He had been an electrician, and he was known for acrobatic dancing on Saturday nights in his neighborhood. And once he became paralyzed, of course, this greatest source of enjoyment in his life was lost. But now he feels that he can be of use to other people because he has become a counselor of other accident victims, and he helps them to accept and overcome their situations. Like many of the other people who had been interviewed, he has more confidence and joy in his life now than he had before the accident.
The
These examples are just some indications of how often in life an initial hardship or even a tragedy can help us direct our energies, focus them, so that we choose our own goals, so that we develop a discipline to learn the skills to overcome the challenges that are presented by the world around. For instance, in a study of 300 of some of the most successful and eminent people, the two authors were a married couple, Goetzel and Goetzel, concluded that practically in most cases, the families of these very successful people had either died early or the parents were alcoholic or they had some other severe problem which affected the early childhood of these future eminent people. Whether it's someone like Winston Churchill, who became the leader of the Western world during World War II, or Wilma Rudolph, who became an Olympic champion as a runner. There are hundreds of these examples of people whose childhood was full of hardship and yet somehow overcame the situation and became eminent in one form or the other. Now, for instance, the French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre said that the greatest gift that a father can give his son is to die early. And the reason for that is that so many successful artists and politicians are orphaned early in life, and it's because of feeling abandoned and feeling left out that they summon the energy to find a direction in life and overcome the obstacles. Now, this seems to contradict the fact that a family that's supportive and warm is going to produce young people who develop an autotelic personality. But in fact, what seems to be so interesting is that adults who learn to control their lives, adults who develop autotelic personalities, seem to come from the two extremes of childhood experience. They come from families that either are supportive and encouraging and stimulating, or they come from families where the hardships are such that the young person as a child has to fight to develop a future for herself or himself. So it's just the kind of great middle ground that is in some ways more dangerous. That is the kind of families that are neither warm and concerned about their children, nor do they have enough challenge for them to kind of react against that hardship. So the point is that one can benefit from hardship too. One can find in the challenges that life presents the inducement, the reason for saying, no, I'm not going to let this happen to me. I'm not going to allow this accident or this situation to overwhelm me. I have to find a way out. And that's where the strength for many people comes that will make it possible for them to have a life which is going to reflect their own goals, which is going to have enough of the discipline and the skills that are necessary for a person to get really involved with what he or she is doing.
Flow and the effects of stress.
Now, in everyday life, even if we don't have these sort of great problems such as being in an accident that deprives us of our limbs or of having come from a childhood which was very difficult, we still have problems. We are constantly exposed to the slings and arrows of fate. We have illness, economic problems, conflicts with family, conflicts on our job. And the cumulative effect of all of these strains that all of us must face is that we do experience stress. Two psychologists who have developed a scale for measuring stress, their names are Holmes and Ray, had listed all of the events that we can face in our life and tried to find a weight that represents how much stress these events have on us. For instance, the highest form of stress that anyone can face is the loss of a child. If you are a parent and you are in the terrible situation of losing a child, that is the strongest form of stress that is generally reported. One of the lowest forms of stresses that people have to confront is Christmas holidays. On a scale of 100, Christmas holidays score 17. So, in a sense, five Christmases begin to approach the highest form of stress that we can have. In between Christmas and the loss of a dear one, there is innumerable causes of stress, like getting a parking ticket or having to decide whether to mortgage your home or having problems at work. All of these create stress. And to the extent that you have stress, you will experience psychic entropy in consciousness. In other words, you will have nagging doubts, nagging problems, conflicting desires, worries that you have to allocate attention to, and to the extent that you do that, you can't achieve this harmonious, concentrated feeling which flow produces. So, in other words, stress will begin to conflict with the ability to enjoy your life. Now, there are ways, of course, to minimize the stress, because as I said at an earlier point, stress is not automatic. Stress is our reaction to external strain. And depending on how we react to the external strain, we can feel these entropy in consciousness, or we don't. And so to a large extent, we can control the effect of external stimuli on our experience.
Three ways to minimize stress.
There are generally three major ways to make sure that stress is not experienced when external conditions produce strain. In studying people who seem to be able to take stress in stride, we find that one of the first conditions is what we have called unselfconscious self-assurance. Unselfconscious is an important factor. As we said before, in flow, you lose consciousness of the self, of the ego. You become involved completely in what you're doing. This ability to lose your self-consciousness is very important also in facing stress. That is, when something is happening outside that could be threatening, if you look at it, external threat, and you become very aware of how the threat could influence you, what terrible things could happen to you if that stressful event were to happen, then you become completely involved with defensive, repressive, worried reactions, and probably your effectiveness, your ability to confront these external strain is going to decline. So it's important to be somewhat detached, to forget about always constantly protecting or worrying about yourself. And the best way to become unselfconscious in this sense is, of course, to be somewhat self-assured. That is, it is people who are fairly secure in their skills, in their abilities, who can afford to forget themselves, who can just operate on the problem rather than having to worry about themselves constantly. A good example would be, suppose you're driving in a car and there is a great amount of traffic. As you move in the traffic and there are cars zigging by, passing you by and cutting into the lanes, if you are too worried about what may happen to you, of getting into an accident, for instance, it's much more likely that the accident, in fact, is going to happen, or at least that you will end up all frazzled at the end of the ride. Whereas if you just pay attention to the traffic and you are constantly at one with your car. You are driving and thinking of the car and thinking of the flow of traffic rather than yourself, then you're much more likely to flow with the traffic and not to feel the stress that this type of driving may result in. And of course, to be an unselfconscious driver in that sense, you should be somewhat assured of yourself. You should have a fairly good feeling about having good reflexes, being able to anticipate what will happen. So the self-assurance is partly a result of past experience and partly a state of mind based on realistic skills. And so to achieve this unselfconscious self-assurance, it's good to have skills, it's good to have a positive attitude about one's past. And if you don't, then you perhaps better give up driving in traffic or take the bus. But to the extent that you can maximize these two elements, you can reduce stress. The second procedure for making stress less likely to affect you was implicit already in what I said before, and that is that you have to focus attention outside. It's not enough to be unselfconscious and to be assured of yourself unless your consciousness is taking in what is happening around you. That focusing attention on what happens, for instance, on the traffic, on the road, if you're driving, is what allows you to actually reduce objectively the nature of the external stress. For instance, on the job you are having problem with your boss, you had a conflict, you had a run-in with your boss. One solution, which is not the good one, is to focus attention on yourself and feel sorry for yourself and worry about what the consequences of this argument will be for you. The other one is to focus attention outside, to try to rehearse what went on, what set off this argument, what was the expression of your boss at different moments during the argument, what motivation may he have had that conflicted with what you say that precipitated this flare-up. So, in other words, you are processing information that is relevant to the event that caused the stress. You are completely involved in the external reality, and it's because of that that you can then hopefully resolve or avoid having the stress happening again. So that, in addition to unselfconscious self-assurance, you have to focus your psychic energy, your attention, on the situation in as objective a way as possible, which of course would be impossible if you were self-conscious, because then most of what goes in your attention is worrying about yourself. If you have these two conditions, then it's much more likely that you will discover new solutions, which is, of course, the way to reduce stress in the long run. You have to remove the causes, you have to understand the problems that caused it, and to do that, you have to have done the first two steps. You had to have to become objective, not self-conscious, you had to focus attention outside, and then you take the whole situation into consideration. You have to think about what is causing the stress in the long run and how can you overcome that now. Finally, as I said before, the third way to confront stress in a useful way is by discovering a new solution to the situation that produces stress.
The Four Habits of an Autotelic Personality.
Whether we are confronted with the kind of tragedies that sudden blindness or losing the use of your limbs brings, or whether we are simply confronted with the small-scale aggravation that the wear and tear of stress in everyday life brings, in either case, our ability to react to the stress in a way that, instead of disturbing our mind and producing psychic entropy, we can react to it so that we experience flow. the difference will be made in terms of whether we have developed an autotelic personality, an autotelic self that can take anything that happens and turn it into a situation which is manageable and perhaps even enjoyable. The autotelic self is one that is differentiated and at the same time integrated. That is a self which is open to experience, which has a variety of interests and skills, and yet one that is harmoniously integrated so that the various goals you have are meaningful and reinforce each other instead of conflicting with each other. To summarize here, in terms of what it takes for an autotelic personality to overcome stress, I will mention four major habits that autotelic people are able to rely on. The first habit is the ability to set goals. And over in these talks, I mentioned that setting goals, not only overall goals, but small goals as you go along, is one of the most important features for transforming activities that otherwise may be boring into activities that will produce flow. For instance, one of the good examples of a person who would have an autotelic self is someone I would call JR, who is actually the CEO of one of the largest financial conglomerates in this country. He's one of these persons whom, when you see him interact in any situations, whether with strangers or colleagues, or whether he's traveling on a plane or stopping in Hong Kong in a hotel or whatever, he always knows what he wants to do in the situation. His goals are constantly popping up and framing his attention, giving him something to accomplish. Whether it's new people or people he knows, whether it's new situations or a new city, he will know what he wants to accomplish there and with this particular people. But I don't want to give the impression that when I say that he always knows what to do with a new person he meets, it's not that he's trying to use everyone. He's trying to understand them. That's the thing that makes him really different from lower level manipulating person. He's not trying to manipulate, to exploit, or to seduce the people he meets. He just wants to understand what they are about and how they fit within the program of his purpose. And if they are interesting people, if they are people with their own intentions, then he will respect that difference and try to understand them anyway, even if it's not something that fits within his plans. But he wants to know who is doing what, why, and for what purpose. So he's, in order to be able to pursue these goals that he sets, JR, like other individuals who have this autotelic personality, they know how to pay attention. And that's the second step of an autotelic personality. Their attention is under their own controls. So, for instance, as they move through the day, they notice everything. They are processing information in a fresh way. They don't use stereotypes. They don't assume that they know what is happening around them. They don't assume that they know the room in which they are, the people they're talking to, but they are freshly noticing their environments, the things they interact with, and not from a selfish point of view again. It's not that they are trying to scope out their environment so that they can use it. They will use the parts of it that fit into their plans, but they are really paying attention because they are interested in what happens around them. Because you know what you want to accomplish and you're paying attention, then the third characteristic of a person like JR is that you become immersed in the activity, that you are not, even though you are objective and to a certain extent detached, you are part of it because you really do notice what happens, and therefore you can react appropriately to what happens. So The outcome of this, of course, is that you learn. You are always learning because you are paying attention and you are relating what you learn to your goals. So you can evaluate what is happening, you can make judgments about it, and you become a knowledgeable participant in everything you do. So you are not left out. You are not an observer. You are not a fellow traveler. You are not a tourist. You are there, part of whatever you do. And this is typical of a person like J.R. If you follow these three steps, namely, you are always setting goals, you are always paying attention, you become immersed in whatever you do, the outcome is that you learn to enjoy whatever you are doing, and that produces a sense of high energy, liveliness, which essentially, in a case, for instance, like J.R., translates itself into the charisma of leadership. This man who is always enjoying whatever he does because he pays attention, because he learns what happens there and he can evaluate everything in terms of his goals, becomes a powerful leader in the eyes of those he works with. But even if you don't want to become a financial leader like JR, you can adopt these habits of goal setting, paying attention, becoming immersed in what you do so that you end up enjoying it, because that is the best strategy for overcoming the stresses of life, whether they are severe or whether they are the ordinary aggravations that all of us must face in our daily existence.
A famous composer explains why he composes.
One doesn't do it for the money. One does it for, perhaps, the satisfaction it gives. I think the great composers, all the great artists, work for themselves, period. They don't care about anybody else. They primarily satisfy themselves. If you get any fame out of it, it's when you're dead and buried. So what's the good of it? This is what I tell my students. Don't expect to make money. Don't expect fame or a pat on the back. Don't expect a darn thing. Do it because you love it.
Perhaps one of the most well-known arenas for producing flow is in the realm of creativity. On this side, you'll learn how it is possible for anyone to develop flow experiences in a creative context.
Albert Michelson was the first American to win a Nobel Prize in Science. He had spent his entire adult life constructing more and more precise ways of measuring the speed of light. It seems like something that would be rather boring to do for one's entire career, but he was one of the most ingenious scientists and experimentalists. And when he was asked in his old age why he had spent all his life building this apparatus for measuring the speed of light, he answered, "It was so much fun." Now, almost every artist who discovers something new, every scientist who pushes knowledge beyond the barriers of the known, enjoy tremendously what they are doing. Anyone who has broken new ground in a field describes the profound joy that he or she derives from the simple act of working. At the same time, talented young people who do not enjoy using their talent will not develop their abilities to their fullest. For you too, if you enjoy what you do, you may not become an Einstein or a Picasso, but it will certainly help make you feel as if you were one of them. Creativity and enjoyment share much in common. Their psychological roots are similar. Both are attempts to avoid psychic entropy or the frustrations and boredom of everyday life. Their consequences are also similar. Creativity and enjoyment both result in a more complex consciousness, although only creativity leads to more complex cultural forms. Not surprisingly, the act of creation, despite its many hardships, is generally described as one of the most profoundly enjoyable experiences available to us. It seems that evolution has built into our nervous system a preference for complexity. Just as we experience pleasure when we do things that are necessary for survival, as we do when we eat and have sex, so we experience enjoyment when we do something that stretches our skills in new directions, when we recognize and master new challenges. The connection between flow and creativity was one that I discovered at the very beginning of my career as a research scientist back in the early 60s. And it was during a study of artists who were working in their studios, painting or doing sculptures. And the most important thing I realized in observing and filming their work was how completely immersed they became in their work and how they could forget fatigue and hunger and sleep if the work they were doing involved them to the point that they were completely immersed in the challenges, the opportunities that the work presented them with. So that is how I discovered flow, actually, is by watching artists. And after that experience, I realized how practically every creative activity produces flow. Every scientist or every inventor, every artist who is creative will describe his work, his life, as being constantly full of these stretches of flow that come from the immersion in what they are doing best. But, of course, what is interesting is that everyday life of people who are not artists, not scientists, can also become enjoyable the moment that you approach it in this creative way, that is, open to novelties, ready to get excited, interested in the kind of things you're doing, whether you are a salesperson or a writer, an editor, or engineer who is manufacturing, whatever the activity you do. It can be done more creatively by putting aside occasionally your assumptions, your prejudices, your preconceived notions, and get immersed in this activity with the excitement and curiosity of a child, trying to understand from scratch, trying to reconsider, re-understand, reinvent what you are doing.
Creativity stems from discovering problems.
And that's how you will be able to see new opportunities, new possibilities, and be able to live and work creatively. Because one of the things we learn about creativity is that the essence of creativity is not so much the solution of problems that are already there, that are already envisioned, but it's the discovery of new problems. Almost all of the great creative breakthroughs and also the small little creative breakthroughs in life are more the result of having realized that there is a new way of thinking, there is a new way of conceptualizing the problem, rather than being confronted with a problem and then saying, okay, how can I solve this? That can be creative too. Problem solving can be done creatively. But the most interesting, the most exciting creative activities come not from solving problems, but from discovering problems, from formulating new problems. And that is typically the result of someone who approaches his life in terms of flow, somebody who is open to new ideas, envisioning new opportunities, and who has this self-assured, unself-conscious involvement, someone who's paying attention, who gets involved with whatever he or she's doing, will have a chance to essentially reinvent his life. Every human being has this creative urge as a birthright. It can be squelched and corrupted, but it cannot be completely extinguished. All flow experiences are potentially creative because they involve facing up to new challenges and mastering them with one's skills. The world may not always see the results of flow as creative, but the person who has the experience knows that he or she has accomplished something new, something difficult, something perhaps beautiful and certainly valuable for oneself. One of the most often mentioned features of flow is the feeling of discovery, the excitement of finding out something new about oneself or about the many opportunities for action that the environment offers. It is because we enjoy discovery and self-discovery that flow is such an important aspect of evolution. For instance, a rock climber describes flow in his sport.
The mystique of rock climbing is climbing. You get to the top of a rock, glad it's over, but really wish it would go on forever. The justification of climbing is climbing, like the justification of poetry is writing. You don't conquer anything except things in yourself.
On a more sober note, a surgeon describes why operating is so enjoyable.
The personal rewards are greatest in challenging cases when you extend the self and think more.
And here is what a chess master says.
It's exhilarating, like I'm succeeding at putting a very hard puzzle together.
In each of these very different activities, joy comes from going beyond what one has already achieved, from mastering new skills and new knowledge.
How flow leads to creativity.
There's perhaps no better way to show the link between creativity and enjoyment than talking again about Linus Pauling, who won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for his creative combination of quantum mechanics and chemistry. And then he won the Nobel Prize later in peace for his efforts to bring atomic weapons under some sort of social control. Well, Pauling, when asked about what kind of advice he would give to young people who were entering the field of scientific research, he answered, "I say, think about what you like best to do. What is it that you enjoy doing? And then find out whether there is a possibility that you can earn your living by doing that. This is as good a way to work toward the goal of leading a good life as there is, and the goal of leading a happy life." The reason that flow naturally leads to creativity is that you can't remain in this balanced state of challenges and skills for long. Suppose that you start, let's say, learning to play tennis. At first, it's quite enjoyable simply to hit the ball with a racket. You're not even concerned of sending it across the net. You just want to hit it fair and square in the middle. And that may be enjoyable, but only for perhaps a few minutes, a few hours. After that, you have developed the skill, and now just hitting the ball becomes boring. You know how to do it, so you need new challenge for enjoying yourself again. So the new challenge maybe again is just to bat the ball across the net without hitting the net. And that challenge may keep you into an enjoyable flow state for a few minutes or perhaps even a few hours, but after that, just batting the ball across the net is no longer enough of a challenge. You have to up the challenges again. So you're looking for a new challenge. While in tennis, it's clear the challenge would be to make sure that when you serve, the ball ends up in the right part of the opponent's court, between the lines where it should be. So that could be a challenge. What I'm trying to say is that as you move into an activity, as you explore the potential of the activity, you will become bored after a while unless you find new challenges. Once the new challenges are in place, when you start realizing what the new challenges can be, then the activity will become enjoyable again for a while, but not for long unless you up the challenges again.
Creating challenges is innate.
There is nothing really very hard about understanding how this desire to make things more complex, to develop new skills, to take on new challenges is. This is not something that only the top creative people have or that is something we have to learn. We have this desire to make things more complex and enjoy new challenges naturally. This is a completely natural part of our heritage. In fact, not only children have it, and they have it more clearly than we do, but even you find it in animals. For instance, I learned a lot from our dogs that we have had over the years. The first dog we had was a hunting dog by the name of Hussar. And whenever I took him to the park to exercise, he spontaneously developed this game of running around me in circles and waiting for me to lounge and try to catch him and at least touch him. And that was a simple enough game, but he very soon learned how to make it more complex. In other words, if one morning I would be sleepy and tired and not jump very far or lunge very far, he would run the circles very narrowly around me, very small circles, so that I had a chance to touch him even if I didn't try very hard. However, if the next morning I felt much more peppy and ambitious, then he would run circles that were much wider around, so that even though I lunged hard, I still had a hard time touching him. In other words, he had spontaneously understood that for us to have fun, we had to match the challenges with the skills. So he did not simply learn to run the same circle around, but adapted himself to this situation and made the interaction for both of us more enjoyable. We found the same thing with our new dog, a Cocker Spaniel, who's called Cedric, and he has a built-in instinct for retrieving birds. That's what he was bred for. His genes tell him to go chase birds. But in the city that we live in, birds of the kind that he was bred to retrieve are not very frequent. So what he has learned is to change his habits that were bred into him, and he's applying his skills to retrieving tennis balls, and he's fantastic at catching balls. He loves to find them even if they fall into deep bushes or ravines. And he becomes incredibly proud when he finds one. And his whole demeanor changes. He walks proudly holding the ball he has found up in the air, showing everybody what a clever dog he is. And when we are at home, when the weather is too cold to find tennis balls in their natural habitat in the park, then we use the tennis balls, we throw them down the hallway, we have a long hallway, and he will go after them, and then after about two times that we throw the ball, the third time, he already is introducing changes and variations in the activity. He will, instead of bringing it back through the hallway, he will go through some other rooms to make the activity more enjoyable, more exciting, more unpredictable. And he will vary the sequence in ways that the simple act of going back and forth through the hallway that would become routine and boring becomes more enjoyable. So the same kind of instinct for making things more enjoyable, more complex, more creative, is something that we all have, animals, children, and it's only as the children grow up that they learn to, in a sense, squelch the notion that you should be discovering, you should be experiencing novelty, you should be introducing creative variation in life that is enjoyable. We teach our children to sit in class the same way, to process information in a routine assembly line way, and instead of discovering things and learning creatively, we package and we kind of force feed the information to children. And at that point, creativity becomes compromised. The habits of living creatively, of thinking creatively, becomes transformed into routine. There is an interesting description of the life of Paolo Uccello, who was one of the great Renaissance painters, one of the inventors of perspective in painting, who lived in the 15th century. And the biographer Vasari, who described how he operated, how he worked, describes how Paolo Uccello, this painter, used to spend all night walking up and down in his garret, muttering to himself Che bella cosa è questa perspettiva. What a beautiful thing perspective is. He had just discovered a way of representing three dimensions in two so that you preserve the illusion of three dimensions. Now, Uccello's wife kept calling him back to bed, saying, forget perspective, let's go to sleep. But Uccello was so immersed in the possibility of actually breaking through in this representation of three dimensions so that you see the perspective of space receding, that sleep had no attraction for him. The same kind of immersion is familiar to anyone who has been involved in creative activities. So what you are doing is your attention becomes sucked in this developing dynamic representation that you have created. We are talking about modern artists living now, not the Renaissance artists like Uccello walking up and down and saying what a beautiful thing perspective is, but the process is the same. That is, you are paying attention, you are getting involved with something that's happening, something that hasn't happened before, and you are part of it. You are not only creating it, but you are actually responding to this potential, this possibility that's developing on the canvas. And many great writers, many great scientists say that, musicians, composers say that they are not really doing the work themselves, that the pen is doing it. They're holding a pen and the pen is writing. What they mean really by that is that they get so involved, they're paying so much attention to what comes out of the pen that they don't consciously separate themselves from the act of writing. They are taken up by it, and of course they are themselves who are writing, but they are no longer conscious of themselves. They are no longer conscious of the effort that went into it. What's inside them is pouring out through the pen, through the hand that holds the pen, and then they are reading what they are writing and they are responding to what they are writing. And this kind of total immersion in the activity is typical of creative activities, and it's the same thing as flow. One physicist that we interviewed, who is very creative, for instance, says that there's only one pen he can write with, and when that pen runs out of ink, he runs out of ideas. He has to stop, refill the pen, and then start writing again. He has achieved such a unity with this particular pen and with the ideas that come tumbling out of his mind on the page, and he is reflecting those ideas that come out, and there is like a circuit established between the mind, the pen, the paper, and then back to the mind. And this feedback loop, this circle that gets established, is what carries the creative activity forward, which produces flow in the creative person.
How to avoid getting stuck.
Of course, not all of the life of a creative artist is full of joy and sunshine. In fact, very often artists feel frustrated, feel depressed. They sometimes have a block that keeps them from writing or painting again. And those obstacles that dam up the creative flow of energy are things that sooner or later almost every creative person experiences, and probably we experience in our lives too. The only sure way to overcome them is to develop the habits that all successful people, all creative people have. They are habits of discipline which force our attention into routines that bypass the big problems, the big conflicts, the big depression that otherwise would capture our energy. So, again, the solution is the same as with all other flow experiences. Develop goals that are manageable. Develop ways of getting started with our work that bypass the great existential dread that waits for us if we don't find ways of eluding it. For instance, almost all great riders have habits, that routines that will get them started riding and forgetting the kind of big problems that would stand in their way. For instance, the French philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau used to spend 20 minutes each morning going out in his courtyard, sitting down under the sun, taking off the wig he wore on his head, and waiting for 20 minutes until his brain was addled by the heat, and then he would put his wig back in place and go back to his study and start writing. That's one way of doing it. The philosopher Immanuel Kant used to sit in his study looking out to a church spire that was a block or two down from his home. And he would wait until the sun shining off the golden globe on top of the church spire kind of almost hypnotized him. When his mind was essentially cleared of all thoughts by this hypnotic trance, he would start writing his deep philosophical ideas. These are two examples of ways in which people do it. Others spend the first 10 minutes booting up their computer, playing around with their computer, or sharpening their pencils if that's what they work with. And as they do these routine activities, they can essentially force their mind into a kind of channel or tunnel that will help the concentration once you start working. Otherwise, you may be too distracted by big problems, too distracted by everyday problems. Even surgeons, before an operation, a difficult operation, they will say that they put themselves on automatic pilot by dressing the same old clothes, having the same kind of breakfast as they always do, driving to work by the same pattern of turns on the street. And then when they get into the hospital, they will change their clothes again, wash their hands, put on scrubs. They perform a ritual that will slowly disengage their mind from the everyday problems and focus it on the task at hand. For the same reason, athletes, baseball players, will have routines of dressing or routines of acting. They will have even little trinkets that they hang from a chain or from their neck, that touching those will allow them to recapture a certain way of thinking or acting that worked for them in the past. The important thing is not to follow any one recipe. I mean, there are hundreds of different ways of doing it. The important thing is to find out what works for you. How can you, with the most ease, achieve the concentration, the involvement with the particular challenges that you are involved with? Whether that challenge is coming home from work to get in tune with your spouse, with your friends, with your children, there must be a way that you can find that tuning in, that getting on the same wavelength without too much problems. If we don't find a way, we will just bring all the problems of the workplace with us, and it will be a conflicting situation. We'll be thinking about other things from the other people in the home, and yet we have to find a way of establishing contact if we want to enjoy the conversation, if we want to enjoy the interaction with them. And the same thing when we go to work in the morning. We have to be able to cut out the distractions, the problems, the worries that we have, so that we can focus in on the job at work. And whether it's morning or afternoon or evening, each of us has to find the most efficient way of conserving energy and focusing energy, and that may require developing rituals, routines, like the basketball players, like the baseball players, like the surgeons, like Kant, like Rousseau. All of us have this task of learning to beam our energy with the greatest focus so that we can achieve our task and enjoy it in the process.
Rayed, a 33-year-old Egyptian who sleeps in the parks of Milan, eats in charity kitchens, and occasionally washes dishes for restaurants when he needs the cash, tells his story.
After the war of 1967, I decided to leave Egypt and start hitchhiking toward Europe. Ever since, I have been living with my mind concentrated within myself. It has not been just a trip. It has been a search for identity. Every man has something to discover within himself. The people